Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. The email during the week is by going to askdrdawn.com and clicking the Contact Us button, and that's what Michelle in Santa Cruz and Hawaii did in the last week. She was basically following up on what I had said about peptides. I had talked a little bit about the legislation and the FDA and this idea that they're going to allow certain peptides to be made by compounding pharmacies, which I'm in favor of. I want to emphasize peptides are a new technology, and the data on them is mostly animal studies. There are a few human studies, but the proliferation of them in the market and the proliferation of websites selling them is kind of like what happened a couple of years ago with GLP-1 drugs. Everybody wanted to sell you this at a quote-unquote discounted price from what the major pharmaceutical companies were charging. And there was a lot of trouble with quality, and that's really the issue with peptides right now. So what the heck are peptides? Put simply, peptides are short chains of amino acid. Hormones, like estrogen, are longer chains. Proteins are longer chains. So insulin is a good example of a hormone that is a pure protein. Estrogen is basically a steroid hormone, so it's got those rings, which are not primarily amino acids. So I want to clarify that. Not all hormones are amino acids, but many of them are. And all proteins are chains of amino acids hooked together in various ways, either twisting up on themselves or locking together in a sort of grid. Collagen is basically a grid of protein that's basically certain the chains fold to get, stick together and make a felt, and that's collagen. So now, as we talk about peptides, they're just small. Well, let's get to Michelle's question. A longer question and story. First of all, the short question is, do peptides heal nerve damage? Here's the longer question. I had a hysterectomy 9 months ago and woke up with painful nerve damage, mostly in my right lower leg, ankle, top of foot, and the first two toes. Also some lower back and right hip pain. After 4 months, it got better, but still hurts after 9 months. The doctors only give me pills, mainly gabapentin, but I don't want to keep taking them, and I wonder if you know if peptides can help me. Thank you. Well, before we get into the peptides, and the quick answer to that is yes, and I'm going to go into some detail and a couple of big buts, but something promising. What happened to Michelle? She was in surgery, and the chief subject here is the positioning that she was placed in surgery. So I'm sure all of you have probably seen a movie where a woman is in labor and she has her feet up in these stirrups and the doctor is sort of between her, the shoulders are between her ankles delivering the baby, and or the midwife, as the case may be. But that's not the best position to deliver a baby, by the way. The best position is squatting or sitting, but we aren't going to go into that discussion. Gravity assist, very helpful when you're trying to deliver a baby. But when you're trying to poop, too, as far as that goes. But let's get back to positioning. When you put someone in that position and then you put them under anesthesia, their muscles relax. And that puts and can put a very big strain on the lower back and the vertebrae. Now, because her symptoms have persisted now for 9 months, it's almost certain that she had some nerve damage, possibly from the way her foot was positioned, possibly from something that got yanked on or twisted during transferring this flaccid body back onto the table. But something clearly seemed to happen at the time of surgery. And given the duration, the possibilities are that there's that she blew a disc and she's pinching a nerve, or she got a crush injury on the nerve. Now, if we look at the femoral nerve at the knee, that would pretty much cover the top of the foot, the first two toes, but she also has lower back and right hip pain. So probably central, but not for sure. Another question I would have would be prior low back pain or disc issues. And most importantly, is the pain getting better or is it spreading or worsening? And is there muscle weakness? Because if any of those are true, you want to go straight to imaging. And even if you've had imaging before, muscle weakness equals imaging, end of discussion. That has to happen. Has she tried physical therapy? What's that been like? These are all open-ended questions. So I want to qualify everything before we just we understand. Now, statistically, after this kind of hysterectomy in that positioning, which is called the lithotomy position, up to 32 people have back pain as a complication of this. Nerve pain is much rarer, 1 to 2%, and persistent nerve pain is even rarer than that. Okay, now we'll go to the short question has a long answer. And the answer is yes. Several peptides show strong evidence of helping repair and protect against nerve damage in mammals. The vast majority of this research is in preclinical animal models. So it's important to understand that there aren't a lot of human studies to base this on. What the human studies we do have say is that, this is probably safe enough to put it out there, but the evidence of effectiveness in humans isn't really there. That's why this special category to allow, it would never meet the criteria for getting an actual approved FDA indication, but it could be allowed through the compounding pharmacy strategy. And so that's what we're trying to do, is essentially clean up the production end of this stuff, allow people to take it, or at least the ones where there's no substantial injury of harm beyond contaminants in the current batches that are for sale on the internet. So let's talk about the various ones. There's probably the most prominent one is BCP-157. BCP stands for Body Protection Compound. This has been widely used in rat models of peripheral nerve injury, which is more than likely a piece of what our emailer has. Rats treated with BCP-157 show significantly improved functional motor recovery after having their sciatic nerve completely severed. Microscopic evaluation showed that they formed thicker myelin sheets. This is the protective insulation around nerves, and that they had increased blood vessel formation within the healing nerve bundles. So this is solid data in rats, but could we extrapolate to human injuries? And we could extrapolate, and we could try it even in late injury. That would be reasonable. Now, the good thing about BP-157 is that it's actually on the list of peptides that would be allowed for compounding. So I think I think this is going to go through. So Michelle, I would say that in a very short period of time, you'll be able to try this yourself, definitely get it through a licensed compounding pharmacy, and maybe it will help you with your recovery. Other natural or functional medicine things that we will often do for nerve recovery is alpha-lipoic acid, which is available in capsules. Your dose would be about 300 milligrams twice a day for 6 months. Then high doses of vitamin B12 and folic acid. And I usually have people take methylfolate because we aren't testing people for the MTHFR mutation. About maybe 10% of the population has at least one mutation in that particular vulnerable area of their DNA. So I just kind of give the methylfolate. It's 6 months. Doses, about 2,000 micrograms of each of these twice a day. This is megadosing, I want to mention, but these are water-soluble molecules. As long as you buy good quality stuff, there's literally no evidence that you will be harmed. And if you feel funny taking it, stop taking it. Right? No brainer. Another interesting peptide is something called intracellular sigma peptide. And this was developed specifically to target central nervous system damage, like spinal cord injuries. When mammals get a CNS injury, the cells create a scar, which is rich in, it's a glial scar, right? It's fibrosis, but it's got a bunch of molecules called CSPGs. And these permanently block nerve regrowth. So the ISP specifically targets the receptor for the CSPG. So it essentially puts bubblegum in the keyhole. So now this compound that's released from the scar isn't able to do its thing. And in landmark rodent studies, the ISP allowed nerve fibers to penetrate through scar tissue, resulting in a, quote, unprecedented recovery of complex motor and bladder function. That one is not on the short list, but it's definitely in development, and we can anticipate that human trials will be funded for this. With any kind of injury treatment, remember these studies, you're dealing with a fresh injury. In this case, unlike that first one, they allowed the scar to form and then were able to show that they could conquer the effects of the scar. This is another one called C3 peptide, also 156-181. And this deactivates a protein that stalls nerve growth. So again, you get active axon and outgrowth. You get enhanced structural maturation of the nerve. And these were used in rats undergoing nerve transplants and dealing with nerve crush injuries. So again, fresh meat, fresh injury. This next one is interesting, copper peptide, also called GHK-CU. Now, one of the interesting things about this one is that it's actually already approved for use in skin products. And yours truly has been using this exact peptide now as one of my skin treatment, anti-aging, if you will, therapies. And I think it works. So I would say that, and of course there's scientific evidence that it does work. It upregulates natural growth factors. So nerve growth factor, neurotropin 3, these are things that are present in the nerve. The copper basically makes their levels higher. And in tissue engineering, it does show that it increases Schwann cells, which are the helper cells that allow nerves to regrow. Bioactive self-assembling peptides, there's a number of these. These are interesting. These are injectable hydrogel scaffolds. So basically, when you have a nerve that gets cut, it's nerve spackle. It's a synthetic chain, bunch of amino acids, and they self-assemble into a 3D matrix mimicking natural tissues. So you can fill a 10 millimeter, that's a centimeter, almost half an inch gap in the sciatic nerve, and they allow for an optimal microenvironment for the physical bridging of the nerve as it tries to grow back. And then the last one here that's got some juice for nerve treatment is one that's called ARA-290. It's also actually got a drug name, sibinotide. And this has early stage chemical trial for small fiber neuropathy. It's actually, as I said, these are proteins, right? And so a lot of hormones are proteins. This one is basically a trim off of EPO or erythropoietin, which is a signal that makes red blood cells grow. This shuts down severe neuroinflammation. It actively reduces the reaction to injury in the microglia of the spinal cord, and it's been used to alleviate neuropathic pain and cold allodynia. So these neuropathic pain, of course, is just epidemic among diabetics. So this thing is getting some serious money and brains thrown at it because we don't have good stuff for neuropathy, especially the small fiber neuropathy. So stay tuned on this. There's one more, called CEMAX, and this one's actually being used internationally for stroke rehab and facial nerve. And it's basically the panel voted very heavily to go ahead and use this. We'll just roll to another email. This one is from Rebecca in Cupertino. And this was also an extremely interesting question, which I'm happy to answer because I think there's valuable information for many of us out there on this topic. And Rebecca wants to know about saunas. Does spending time in an infrared sauna carry risks of skin aging or skin cancer? Do you have any recommendations as to features or certifications to look for in choosing a home infrared sauna? Example, EMF, spectrum, VOC generation, addition of an oxygen ionizer. So, Rebecca, let's start with EMF, electromagnetic frequency radiation. This is comes off of any electrical wire. And the EPA recommends all household appliances being electrical wires, they're going to create some EMF. Just to give you an idea of the range in household appliances, a hairdryer produces 300 milligauss at close range. So when you've got that hairdryer up near your ear, you're putting an awful lot of EMF across your skull and into your brain. Hopefully you've got a nice thick skull as well as nice thick hair. The EPA says for your household environment, it should be 3 milligauss. So that's 300 times. Of course, we're only spending maybe a minute or two ourselves with the hairdryer that close to our head. But, you know, you've got to wonder about people working at salons who are doing a lot of blow drying and they're waving that thing around their chest. You know, could they be hurting themselves? And the answer is no data. So the EMF that you get from a sauna is in the heater panels. And the cheaper, it's the EMF is extremely low frequency. That's what you get from these things. And it's 10 to 30 milligauss near the heater. So the cabins can be shielded. And so when you're looking for your product, you want to have a low or no EMF cabin. And these have shielded and grounded heating elements. And when you measure the field inside these, it's less than 1 milligauss at the level of the seat, so where your body would be. So you want to avoid unshielded, and you also want to watch out for unshielded Wi-Fi or Bluetooth control panels within the cabin. So that's something else to keep in mind because those increase your exposure. The other thing that it's important to watch out for is the VOC, which is volatile organic compounds. Because infrared saunas operate between 110 and 135
Fahrenheit.
And the best infrared saunas are going to be the far infrared. So, sorry, off the top of my head, I don't know the definition, but that's an easy Google. You want to be on the far side of the infrared frequencies. That means the infrareddest of them all. And that's going to heat to 110 to 135. So the structural materials get a lot of thermal stress. And that creates a problem with indoor air quality due to off-gassing. VOC emissions can spike by 300 to 500% compared with the room temperature baselines. And, of course, when you're in a sauna, you're breathing a bit deeper because you're essentially panting. Even if you're breathing slowly, you are trying to lose some heat. So that increases your toxic load. The cheaper saunas that are constructed of plywood, particle board, or medium density fiberboard, or MDF, use synthetic glues, resins, and binders. And these materials aggressively off-gas formaldehyde and benzene, which are very toxic lung irritants, and, oops, known carcinogen. So you really have to look at what kind of wood. And even solid woods can release natural VOCs called terpenes. So the ones to watch out for are western red cedar and pine, because they release more than 50 times the VOCs than non-toxic hardwoods. What you want to look for is poplar, basswood, or, surprisingly enough, eucalyptus. And these terpenes can cause airway irritation. They can... So the other thing about the spas is that the temperature
regulation can be very poor. So you want to seek brands that provide independent third-party heated cabin testing. And there are EPA-accredited laboratory methods for this. So that is the first part of it. But then we're also going to talk about the oxygen ionizers that you asked about. So many manufacturers put in built-in oxygen ionizers or negative air ionizers. My advice is to stay away from these. These do not generate oxygen. They generate negatively charged air molecules. And the negative ions in the air attach to things that are airborne, like dust and skin flakes, and they give them a static charge. So they clump, and then they get heavy, and rather than floating around in your breathing zone, they drop to the floor, and you can sweep them out. But the primary hazard here is that the method that that these ions are created is called coronal discharge. And this inherently creates ozone as a byproduct. Ozone is a severe lung irritant, and even small amounts in an confined, unventilated, heated sauna cabin can cause chest tightness, shortness of breath, and aggravate asthma. And these devices, when you open the air and get out of the sauna, the ions that come out actually interact with the materials in your newly remodeled bathroom to create more oxygenated volatile organic compounds. So, yeah, I would stay away from the ionizers. So moving on to some stories, I put a question after reading something in an article. I wanted to fact test it. I generally fact tested because it said that there were many, many drugs that raised estrogen in middle-aged men. And why would we not want that? Well, for one thing, estrogen is a growth hormone. And it turns out that elevated estrogen actually increases the risk of prostate cancer. Never good. When you get to the list, however, it's pretty astonishing. Almost all antidepressants and anti-epileptic drugs raise estrogen in men. Nonsteroidal anti-inflammatories, statins, many blood pressure medications, and a lot of GI medications like the proton pump inhibitors for heartburn, cimetidine, so basically Tagamet, Axit, Zantac, Nexium, and omeprazole. So just about everything that you would take for your gut, some of the antiarrhythmics, practically all of the Parkinson's disease medications. Interestingly enough, naproxen and indomethacin, but not ibuprofen, that raise it in men. Just about all of the antihistamines do it. A couple of a lot of the prostate cancer medications ironically raise estrogen levels because they're trying to get rid of testosterone. But it's kind of interesting. And muscle relaxants like Flexeril and Norflex. So the best answer here, because a lot of people are on these medications, is I believe that men should be monitoring their estrogen levels at their annual physical and just looking at their estrogen to testosterone levels and look at the reference range. And if your testosterone is at the low end of normal and your estrogen is at the high end of normal, then you want to take a look at maybe treating that and rebalancing that. And there are a number of things that will do that. See, I'm not creating a problem without giving you some solutions. One of them is a topical drug that you rub into your skin called Crisin, and this prevents testosterone from being turned into estrogen. Another is a compound called indole-3-carbinol. I give this to a lot of my women with either breast disease or breast cancer. It helps reduce the production and help your body detoxify the estrogen. Calcium deglycerate is another health food store compound. This blocks a hormone that's hormone production in the intestines, basically estrogen that's been marked for disposal to stay in the gut and basically be pooped out, is freed up and turned back into the lipid-soluble estrogen that can dissolve right across the bowel wall and get back into the bloodstream. And another one is soy. And soy works by competitive inhibition. So it doesn't lower the estrogen levels directly, but it blocks the estrogen's formation, just like that bubblegum in the keyhole mechanism that we talked about earlier. If you block the receptor for something, it's the same as if you eliminated the thing itself. One more thing that's also an excellent antioxidant is grape skin extract. So those are some natural things that you can do to help rebalance your estrogen if you find it's elevated. And we're going to move on to our first real story of the evening, which is that we now have official approval of the first mRNA-based flu vaccine. This was announced just literally yesterday, and it is great news. This new flu shot is an mRNA vaccine for flu. It's available to adults 50 and over, and it's recommended. It's recommended for basically, it's going to be paid for if you're over 65. If you're between 50 and 64, you may have to check with your insurance company to see if it's covered. Why is this such a big deal? Because next year, if we can develop the flu vaccine much quicker, and if we get a strain showing up that we did not anticipate, like if we're not seeing any bird flu, and then suddenly we start seeing bird flu. Remember bird flu? It's still out there, folks. So if that bird flu mutates to become more respiratorily transmitted in humans, that would be a moment when we would want to pull out the full stops, get that sequence from the bird flu, and then start manufacturing our mRNA vaccine. It's kind of like the mRNA vaccine is like a syringe. You can load it with anything you need to load it. Otherwise, we have to grow the vaccine for the flu shot, and it takes 3 or 4 months and to do that at all, and then you have to scale it. So it's late spring is about the latest we can wait to take our best guess at what we're going to need in the fall. And this completely torpedoes that as a problem because we will be able to spin on the dime. It was interesting because this had become a political thing because, you know, Vinay Prasad, who was the vaccine chief, was like very against mRNA. RFK has criticized mRNA technology. And so this was one of those situations where the committee said, no, we approve it. And then there was pushback basically from industry saying, you know, if you're going to go changing the rules on vaccines, we lose money on vaccines. This is not a profit center for us. We'll just stop making vaccines and blame you. And they actually backed down. So this particular shot is 27% more effective against seasonal flu. They tested it out last year. The downside, it hurts a bit more. There's more injection site pain and more fatigue. And I think that's going to probably be a truism for mRNA vaccines in general. And the question is, I'm definitely getting ready to get my flu shot. I usually do it, way before Thanksgiving. But when I start seeing Halloween paraphernalia in the stores, that's my cue to go get a flu shot. Not counting Costco, because they have Halloween stuff up year-round now, so not them. You want to get it in the early fall. All right, a new study came out that links exposure. This came out of Spain, so it's not the United States. It's coming out of the EU, and it was interesting because it supported something I talked about recently, with respect to environmental pollutants, particularly pesticides used in farming, potentially contributing to early menarche and girls getting their periods early early puberty in girls is easier to spot than in boys, because, you know, they start bleeding. It's like, yeah, that's a mark. We can also look at breast formation, which is another physical change that happens earlier, and earlier as it happens in girls. This study is good. I'm going to just do a little segue into why it's a good study. It was a prospective study, meaning that they didn't do a look back at data. They actually found their group of 500 people, which is a decent number, not too big, not too small. And they had a good objective marker for exposure, so they weren't guessing. It wasn't a food diary. It wasn't parental recall. It was actually urine measuring for chemicals. And they did a baseline when the girls were between 7 and 10, and that was between 2013 and 2016. And then they followed the girls till they were 14 to 16. And by then they had their other solid data point, which was the first menstrual period. So these are solid markers. I always say with the Alzheimer's studies, you know, you're taking a test, right? It might be a multiple choice test. It might be, you know, draw, is this a rhinoceros or a hippopotamus kind of visual test. There might be some mathematics involved. But the thing is, you know, people vary a lot with their mental functioning. I vary a lot with my mental functioning, depending on the time of day and how much sleep I got and a whole host of other variables. So that makes the data for Alzheimer's very, very muddy. And so it's there's a bigger chance of just not thinking you found something when you really haven't found it, or finding something and not know you found it because the data is too fuzzy to show it. So what are the compounds that they really boiled it down to? Early periods were associated with higher concentrations of something called ethylene thiouria, which comes from a whole class of dithiocarbonate type fungicides. These are used widely locally because of strawberry production. And the compound is also known to be an anti-thyroid agent, so it can possibly affect thyroid hormones. The younger the child, the more sensitive they are to these chemicals. And they also found the opposite. They found a metabolite of a very widely used insecticide called chlorpyrifos. And this was associated with a delay in the onset of menarche. And this effect was more pronounced in girls who were overweight or obese, which, of course, may have to do with the fact that they were going to concentrate that particular metabolite in fat tissue, so they would have a chance, their bodies would hang on to more of it if it was one of the ones that dissolved into fat rather than dissolving into muscle. So good data out of the EU, making us think about really carefully about protecting our children from the effects of environmental pollution. On the subject of that, I'm really going to come down in favor of organic strawberries here, and also just being aware of the fumigation when you see those plastics on the fields. This is a time not to let your kids play near those fields, and be aware that those compounds will be broken down in the body into something that could potentially cause early puberty. And honestly, we don't know whether that means early cancer, more endometriosis. We have no idea what it actually amounts to. It may impair fertility for all we know. We don't have the data, but we do see a change that we don't want to see. So my attitude is better safe than sorry on these chemicals. On the other hand, I do like my strawberries, so organic is the way to go. All right, our next story is about drug development, but it definitely falls into the medical news of the weird. It's one of my favorite categories. Cancer-fighting chewing gum cuts human papillomavirus by up to 93%. This research comes out of the School of Dental Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. Lead researcher is Henry Daniel. One of the things that dentists see frequently is head and neck squamous cell carcinoma. It's just a little bite patch on the inside of the cheek or on the tongue. It's not the sort of thing that people notice about themselves. Dentists are trained to look for it because squamous cell carcinoma can be particularly aggressive. And because of its location, it's often already spread to the brain or into structures in the head where we really do not want to be going and hacking stuff out because it's very disabling and potentially quite disfiguring. There are many recently approved cancers that have not really done, medications that have not really done much to treat this cancer. And so where we need to go is at the prevention. So this is research that's been building for a while. There is a type of chewing gum that's made from lab beans. And it's a gum that's in beans, right? And this gum naturally contains an antiviral protein called FRIL. So Daniel and his colleagues used oral samples taken from patients who have head and neck squamous cell cancer. And they looked at three microorganisms, or I guess you can call human papillomavirus a microbe, even though it's not alive. Two bacteria that live in the teeth, Fusobacterium nucleatum and Porphyromonas gingivalis. And, you know, if you were to floss and put it on a plate, you'd probably grow out some of this. But what we find is that these bacteria in particular aggravate and worsen the growth of metastatic of oral cancer, and in fact tend to contribute to recurrence. And human papillomavirus is a causative factor in HPV infection. So once a person gets it, the longer they have this type of HPV in their mouth, the more probability there is that they will get cancer. Use of oral tobacco products drastically increases this risk, by the way. So stay away from those. And essentially, chewing the gum lowered the amount of these compounds in the oral mucosa. So it needs to be tested and will be tested as a therapeutic tool in head and neck cancer to see if they can reduce metastasis. More news on the drug development front around two very, very deadly poisonous plants that are capable of causing nerve damage and paralysis at extremely low doses, but they contain compounds with many valuable uses. They could be used against malaria, pain, cancer, and agricultural pests. There's sort of an interesting serendipity story, which is a good reason to go to a medical conference. So the work is brought together by work focused on wolfsbane and larkspur. These plants are both known to create aconite, which has lots of good properties and has been impossible to synthesize. So plants are really good at chemistry. They have been upgrading their arsenal of natural compounds over millions of years to help them survive attacks by insects, bacteria, and nematodes and all that good stuff, or bad stuff. Humans have found countless uses for these molecules, just presumably by trial, error, and the transmission of information down generational lines. And so we have menthol, capsaicin, vanillin, caffeine, and many other things that are used, berberine, which comes from echinacea, the plant echinacea. There's just so many things that you can use. The Hamburger Lab at MSU studies these substances, but they specialize in, at the moment, delphiniums, which is also known as larkspur. And the plants produce a type of alkaloids that are highly toxic, but in small doses have really profound good medical properties. At a scientific conference in Barcelona, Hamburger met researchers from Thomas Pluskal's laboratory at the Czech Academy of Sciences. And the Pluskal group includes Dr. Mutabdisha, who was studying the same family of diterpene alkaloids, but not in delphiniums, in wolfsbane. otherwise known as monkshood. And so by joining forces, they set out to break down, okay, how is this stuff made? How do the plants make it? Quoting Miller, you could imagine the biosynthetic pathway almost as an assembly line. If you have 10 steps in a row needed to build a finished product, and suddenly one step quits, the next step just can't happen. And this is how many complex molecules in our body are made. They're made on a sort of assembly line. And the first part of the assembly line, as for example, cholesterol as the chassis, if you will, that all of the steroid hormones are built off of, you essentially start on the same assembly line and then branch off in different directions to make the finished product. Statins work by disrupting the upstream pathway that eventually downstream leads to LDL, but on another pathway, on one of the other branches, it leads to CoQ10. So you impact adversely the production of an important antioxidant and mitochondrial protective compound in order to lower the cholesterol. And the problem is these plants make these metabolites for their own purposes, very slow pace, and it's hard to extract enough to use these things at an industrial level. But biohacking is what these guys did. So they were able, after a few years, they were able to discover the process that this was made and what genes were activated to make. So essentially genes make enzymes. Enzymes are the tools in this assembly line. And that helps shape a very complicated molecule that can then be used in medicine. It's also poisonous if you take too much of it, like many medicines, and like many foods, as far as that goes, the poison is in the dose. I can also kill you with too much salt or too much sugar. So the poison is in the dose. What they were able to do, having discovered this process, is they were able to clone it into tobacco. Now, unlike larkspur and monkshood, tobacco is kind of got the properties of a weed. It grows fast. It makes a lot of what it makes. And, of course, it's been bred over the years and selected to do exactly that in the case of nicotine. But you can you can basically hijack the metabolic processes of the tobacco plant, and they turn out tons of aconite. So we are at an age where we're moving forward, but we're looping around to the old herbalists and the old gatherers who knew the properties of these things and knew how to use them. And now we're able to scale that using genetically altered plants to produce large quantities. I mean, think about the cloning of insulin and how that transformed healthcare 50 years ago. It was a huge, big deal. And that's the sort of thing we can expect to come forward in the next few years if, and I would say, if we don't fund it here, somebody over in Europe or in the former Eastern Bloc or in somewhere in Africa or somewhere in Asia is going to fund it and going to patent it and have the product to the market first and go them, right? I just want to be able to buy it. And if we are stepping back because we're tangled up, I guess that's the best way to put it. I think we are tangled up in this country and we need to try to disentangle politics from science pronto. And I sure hope that happens. So let's see. I have another email, so we might as well close with an email. Let me find it. So Carl, and I don't know where Carl was from, but Carl sent an email asking about aortic aneurysm or an enlarged aorta. And Carl had a CT scan for another purpose, and that CT scan had said that the aorta was enlarged. And so Carl was wondering, well, what does this mean and what do I do about it? So Carl, here's your answer. First of all, remember the number 4 centimeters, because if your aorta is a little bit enlarged, it's not really officially an aneurysm until it gets to 4 centimeters. And 4 centimeters means we monitor it every year. And if it gets up to 5 centimeters, then we're monitoring it every 6 months to a year, depending on how long it took to get there. If it's getting bigger faster, we're on the shorter thing. And in fact, if you're a smoker, a current smoker, the most important thing, Carl, is you have to get off cigarettes, because cigarette smoke directly weakens the aorta. Let me say that again. Tobacco smoke directly weakens the aorta, makes it more likely to stretch and more likely to tear. And when you tear, you suddenly dump half of your blood volume into your abdomen, and there's nothing to stop. And your blood pressure crashes, and your probability of survival is less than 50% for a ruptured aortic aneurysm. Sometimes they dissect instead of rupturing outright. There you have a little bit more chance, and the sensation that you will get, Carl, if you dissect your aneurysm is a zipping pain on your back, like someone had a zipper made of fire and ran it up or down your back. You get that sensation, you call 911. That's an aneurysm dissecting. And those are easier to fix because you don't lose all of your blood and go into shock. So what do we want to do? We want to monitor you, depending on the size, using ultrasound. And we want to look at the growth rate over time. And we want you to control your blood pressure. Your goal here is under 130 over 80. And whatever it takes, drug-wise, behavior-wise, exercise-wise, and by the way, exercise is fine. It's good for you. It will not cause that aneurysm to open up faster. It will probably slow the growth of it. For those of you who are over 65 and are ex-smokers, Medicare will actually cover one screening ultrasound to make sure you don't have an aneurysm for any ever smokers. So even if you quit 20 or 30 years ago, if you're over 65, you should definitely go and get an abdominal ultrasound. Your regular primary care doctor can order that for you. And they'll probably even do it just if you ask and say, yeah, I used to smoke and quit in 1982. And I'm 65. And they'll go, yeah, sure, here, go have it. It's important we find those cases early and monitor them. In a way, this incidentaloma that you had, where an incidental finding on a CT scan done for another reason, may very well be a pivotal moment in allowing you to catch something early. It is early, based on what you're telling me. So annual screening is all you really need to do. Stop smoking and keep a lid on that blood pressure.
Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.